Chapter 7, Farmer 23. Store Jendabal jogged along the country road outside the university. It was not common practice for second foundationers to venture into the farming world of Trantor. They could do so, certainly, but when they did not venture either far or for long. Jendabal was an exception, and he had in times past wondered why. Wondering meant exploring his own mind, something that speakers in particular were encouraged to do. Their minds were at once their weapons and their targets, and they had to keep both offence and defence well honed. Jendabal had decided, to his own satisfaction, that one reason he was different was because he had come from a planet that was both colder and more massive than the average inhabited planet. When he was brought to Trantor as a boy, through the net that was quietly cast throughout the galaxy by agents of the Second Foundation on the lookout for talent, he found himself, therefore, in a lighter gravitational field and a delightfully mild climate. Naturally, he enjoyed being in the open more than some of the others might. In his early years on Trantor, he grew conscious of his puny, undersized frame, and he was afraid that settling back into the comfort of a benign world would turn him flabby indeed. He therefore undertook a series of self-developing exercises that had left him still puny in appearance, but kept him wiry and with a good wind. Part of his regimen were these long walks and joggings, about which some of the speakers' table muttered. Jendabal disregarded their chattering. He kept his own ways, despite the fact that he was first generation. All the others at the table were second and third generation, with parents and grandparents who had been second foundationers, and they were all older than he, too. What, then, was to be expected but muttering? By long custom, all minds at the speaker's table were open, supposedly altogether, though it was a rare speaker who didn't maintain a corner of privacy somewhere, in the long run, ineffectively, of course. All minds at the speaker's table were open, and Jendabal knew that what they felt was envy. So did they. Just as Jendabal knew his own attitude was defensive, overcompensating ambition, and so did they. Besides, Jendabal's mind reverted to the reasons for his ventures into the hinterland, besides, he had spent his childhood in a whole world, a large and expansive one with grand and variegated scenery, and in a fertile valley of that world, surrounded by what he believed to be the most beautiful mountain ranges in the galaxy. They were unbelievably spectacular in the grim winter of that world. He remembered his former world and the glories of a now distant childhood. He dreamed about it often. How could he bring himself to be confined to a few dozen square miles of ancient architecture? He looked about disparagingly as he jogged. Trantor was a mild and pleasant world, but it was not a rugged and beautiful one. Though it was a farming world, it was not a fertile planet. It never had been. Perhaps that, as much as any other factor, had led to its becoming the administrative centre of first an extensive union of planets, and then of a galactic empire. There was no strong push to have it to be anything else. It wasn't extraordinarily good for anything else, either. After the Great Sack, one thing that kept Trantor going was its enormous supply of metal. It was a great mine, supplying 50 worlds with cheap alloy steel, aluminium, titanium, copper, magnesium, returning in this way what it had collected over thousands of years, depleting its supplies at a rate of hundreds of times faster than the original rate of accumulation. There were still enormous metal supplies available, but they were underground and harder to obtain. The Hamish farmers, who never called themselves Trantorians, a term they considered ill-omened, and which the Second Foundation has therefore reserved for themselves, had grown reluctant to deal with the metal any further. Superstition, undoubtedly. Foolish of them. The metal that remained underground might well be poisoning the soil and further lowering its fertility, and yet, on the other hand, the population was thinly spread, and the land supported them. And there were some sales of metal, always. Jendabal's eyes roved over the flat horizon. Trantor was alive geologically, as almost all inhabited planets were, but it had been 100 million years at least since the last major geological mountain-building period had occurred. What uplands existed had been eroded into gentle hills. Indeed, many of them had been levelled during the great metal-coating period of Trantor's history. Off to the south, well out of sight, was the shore of Capital Bay, and beyond that the Eastern Ocean, both of which had been re-established after the disruption of the underground systems. To the north were the towers of Galactic University, obscuring the comparatively squat but wide library, most of which was underground, and the remains of the Imperial Palace still further north. Immediately on either side were farms, on which there was an occasional building. He passed groups of cattle, goats, chickens, the wide variety of domesticated animals found on any Trantorian farm. None of them paid him any mind. Jendabal thought casually that anywhere in the galaxy, on any of the vast number of inhabited worlds, he would see these animals, and that on no two worlds would they be exactly alike. He remembered the goats of home and his own tame nanny, whom he had once milked. They were much larger and more resolute than the small and philosophical specimens that had been brought to Trantor and established there since the Great Sack. Over the inhabited worlds of the galaxy, there were varieties of each of these animals, in numbers almost beyond counting, and there was no sophisticate on any world who didn't swear by his favourite variety, whether for meat, milk, eggs, wool, or anything else they could produce. As usual, there were no Hamish in view. Jendabal had the feeling that the farmers avoided being seen by those whom they referred to as scowlers, a mispronunciation, perhaps deliberately, of the word scholars in their dialect. Superstition again. Jendabal glanced up briefly at Trantor's sun. It was quite high in the sky, but its heat was not oppressive. In this location, at this latitude, the warmth stayed mild and the cold never bit. Jendabal even missed the biting cold sometimes, or so he imagined. He had never revisited his native world. Perhaps, he admitted to himself, because he didn't want to be disillusioned. He had the pleasant feel of muscles that were sharpened and tightened to keenness, and he decided he had jogged just long enough. He settled down to a walk, breathing deeply. He would be ready for the upcoming table meeting, and for one last push to force a change in policy, a new attitude that would recognise the growing danger from the First Foundation and elsewhere, and that would put an end to the fatal reliance on the perfect working of the plan. When would they realise that the very perfection was the surest sign of danger? Had anyone but himself proposed it, he knew, it would have gone through without trouble. As things stood now, there would be trouble, but it would go through just the same, for old Shandes was supporting him and would undoubtedly continue to do so. He would not wish to enter the history books as the particular first speaker under whom the Second Foundation had withered. Hamish! Jendabal was startled. He became aware of the distant tendril of mind well before he saw the person. It was Hamish Mind, a farmer, coarse and unsubtle. Carefully, Jendabal withdrew, leaving a touch so light as to be undetectable. Second Foundation policy was very firm in this respect. The farmers were the unwitting shields of the Second Foundation. They must be left as untouched as possible. No one who came to Trantor for trade or tourism ever saw anything other than the farmers, plus perhaps a few unimportant scholars living in the past. Remove the farmers, or merely tamper with their innocence, and the scholars would become more noticeable, with catastrophic results. That was one of the classic demonstrations which neophytes at the university were expected to work out for themselves. The tremendous deviations displayed on the prime radiant, when the farmer minds were even slightly tampered with, were astonishing. Jendabal saw him. It was a farmer, certainly, Hamish to the core. He was almost a caricature of what a Trantorian farmer should be. Tall and wide, brown-skinned, roughly dressed, arms bare, dark-haired, dark-eyed, a long, ungainly stride, Jendabal felt as though he could smell the barnyard about him. Not too much scorn, he thought. Prime Palver had not minded playing the role of farmer when that was necessary to his plans. Some farmer he was, short and plump and soft. It was his mind that had fooled the teenage Arcady, never his body. The farmer was approaching him, clumping down the road, staring at him openly, something that made Jendabal frown. No Hamish man or woman had ever looked at him in this manner. Even the children ran away and peered from a distance. Jendabal did not slow his own stride. There would be room enough to pass the other, with neither comment nor glance, and that would be best. He determined to stay away from the farmer's mind. Jendabal drifted to one side, but the farmer was not going to have that. He stopped, spread his legs wide, stretched out his large arms, as though to block passage, and said, "Oh, Be you scholar? Try as he might, Gendebal could not refrain from sensing the wash of pugnacity in the approaching mind. He stopped. It would be impossible to attempt to pass by without conversation, and that would be in itself a weary task. Used as one was to the swift and subtle interplay of sound and expression and thought and mentality that combined to make up the communication between second foundationers, it was wearisome to resort to word combination alone. It was like prying up a boulder by arm and shoulder, with a crowbar lying nearby. Gendebal said quietly and with careful lack of emotion, "I am a scholar, yes." "Ho, oh, you are my scholar. Don't we speak outlandish now? And cannot I see that you be one or am one?" He ducked his head in a mocking bow. "Being as you be, small and weazen and pale and up-nosed." "What is it you want of me, Hamishman?" asked Gendebal unmoved. "I be titled Ruffierant, and Carral be my previous." His accent became noticeably more Hamish. His R's rolled throatily. Gendebal said, "What is it you want with me, Carral Ruffierant?"
"And I'll be you titled Scholar."
"Does it matter?"
"You may continue to call me Scholar." "If I ask, it matters that I be answered, little up-nosed Scowler."
"Well then, I am titled Stor Gendebal, and I will now go about my business."
"What be your business?"
Gendebal felt the hair prickling on the back of his neck. There were other minds present. He did not have to turn to know that there were three more Hamishmen just behind him. Off in the distance there were others. The farmer's smell was strong.
"My business, Carral Ruffierant, is certainly none of yours." "Say you so?"
Ruffierant's voice rose.
"Mates, he says his business be not ours."
There was a laugh from behind him, and a voice sounded.
"Right he be, for his business be bookmuckin' and putter-rubbin', and be naught for true men."
"Whatever my business is," said Gendebal firmly, "I will be about it now."
"And how will you do that, wee scholar?" said Ruffierant.
"By passing you."
"You would try? You would not fear arm-stoppin'?"
"By you and all your mates, or by you alone?" Gendebal suddenly dropped into thick Hamish dialect.
"Art not feared alane?"
Strictly speaking, it was not proper to prod him in this manner, but it would stop a mass attack, and that had to be stopped, lest it force a still greater indiscretion on his part. It worked. Ruffierant's expression grew lowering.
"If fear there be, bookboy, thou art the one to be full of it. Mates, make room, stand back, and let him pass, that he may see if I be feared alone."
Ruffierant lifted his great arms and moved them about. Gendebal did not fear the farmer's pugilistic science, but there was always a chance that a goodly blow might land. Gendebal approached cautiously, working with delicate speed within Ruffierant's mind, not much, just a touch, unfelt, but enough to slow reflexes that crucial notch, then out and into all the others, who were now gathering in greater numbers. Gendebal's speaker's mind darted back and forth with virtuosity, never resting in one mind long enough to leave a mark, but just long enough for the detection of something that might be useful. He approached the farmer cat-like, watchful, aware and relieved that no one was making a move to interfere. Ruffierant struck suddenly, but Gendebal saw it in his mind before any muscle had begun to tighten, and he stepped to one side. The blow whistled past, with little room to spare, yet Gendebal still stood there, unshaken. There was a collective sigh from the others. Gendebal made no attempt to either parry or return a blow. It would be difficult to parry without paralyzing his own arm, and to return a blow would be of no use, for the farmer would withstand it without trouble. He could only maneuver the man as though he were a bull, forcing him to miss. That would serve to break his morale, as direct opposition would not. Bull-like and roaring, Ruffierant charged. Gendebal was ready and drifted to one side just sufficiently to allow the farmer to miss his clutch. Again the charge, again the miss. Gendebal felt his own breath begin to whistle through his nose. The physical effort was small, but the mental effort of trying to control without controlling was enormously difficult. He could not keep it up long. He said as calmly as he could, while batting lightly at Rufarad's fear-depressant mechanism, trying to rouse in a minimalist manner what must surely be the farmer's superstitious dread of scholars, "I will now go about my business." Rufarad's face distorted with rage, but for a moment he did not move. Jindabal could sense his thinking. The little scholar had melted away like magic. Jindabal could feel the other's fear rising, and for a moment... But then the Hamish rage surged higher and drowned the fear. Rufarad shouted, "Mates, scholar be dancer! He do duck on nimble toes and scorns the rules of honest Hamish blow for blow. Seize him, hold him. We will trade blow for blow, then. He may be first striker, gift of me, and I will be last striker." Jindabal found the gaps among those who now surrounded him. His only chance was to maintain a gap long enough to get through, then to run, trusting to his own wind and to his ability to dull the farmer's will. Back and forth he dodged, with his mind cramping in effort. It would not work. There were too many of them, and the necessity of abiding within the rules of Trantorian behaviour was too constricting. He felt hands on his arms. He was held. He would have to interfere with at least a few of the mines. It would be unacceptable, and his career would be destroyed. But his life, his very life, was at hazard. How had this happened? 24. The meeting of the table was not complete. It was not the custom to wait if any speaker were late. Nor, thought Shandus, was the table in a mood to wait in any case. Stor Jindabal was the youngest and far from sufficiently aware of the fact. He acted as though youth were in itself a virtue and age a matter of negligence on the part of those who should know better. Jindabal was not popular with the other speakers. He was not, in point of fact, entirely popular with Shandus himself. But popularity was not at issue here. Delora Delamy broke in on his reverie. She was looking at him out of wide blue eyes, her round face with its accustomed air of innocence and friendliness, masking an acute mind to all but other second foundationers of her own rank, and ferocity of concentration. She said, smiling, "First speaker, do we wait longer?" The meeting had not yet been formally called to order, so that, strictly speaking, she could open the conversation, though another might have waited for Shandus to speak first by right of his title. Shandus looked at her disarmingly, despite the slight breach in courtesy. "Ordinarily we would not, Speaker Delamy, but since the table meets precisely to hear Speaker Jindabal, it is suitable to stretch the rules." "Where is he, First Speaker?" "That, Speaker Delamy, I do not know." Delamy looked about the rectangle of faces. There was the first speaker, and what should have been 11 other speakers. Only 12. Through 5 centuries, the Second Foundation had expanded its powers and its duties, but all attempts to expand the table beyond 12 had failed. 12 it had been after Selden's death, when the second first speaker, Selden himself had always been considered as having been the first of the line, had established it, and 12 it still was. Why 12? That number divided itself easily into groups of identical size. It was small enough to consult as a whole and large enough to do work in subgroups. More would have been too unwieldy, fewer too inflexible. So went the explanations. In fact, no one knew why the number had been chosen or why it should be immutable. But then, even the Second Foundation could find itself a slave to tradition. It took Delamy only a flashing moment to have her mind twiddle the matter as she looked from face to face and mind to mind, and then sardonically at the empty seat, the junior seat. She was satisfied that there was no sympathy at all with Jindabal. The young man, she had always felt, had all the charm of a centipede and was best treated as one. So far, only his unquestioned ability and talent had kept anyone from openly proposing trial for expulsion. Only 2 speakers had been impeached, but not convicted, in the hemi-millennial history of the Second Foundation. The obvious contempt, however, of missing a meeting of the table was worse than many an offence, and Delamy was pleased to sense that the mood for trial had moved forward rather more than a notch. She said, "First Speaker, if you do not know the whereabouts of Speaker Jindabyne, I would be pleased to tell you." "Yes, Speaker?" "Who among us does not know that this young man," she used no honorific in speaking of him, and it was something that everyone noted, of course, "finds business among the Hamish continually. What that business might be, I do not ask, but he is among them now, and his concern with them is clearly important enough to take precedence over this table." "I believe," said another of the speakers, "that he merely walks or jogs as a form of physical exercise." Delamy smiled again. She enjoyed smiling. It cost her nothing. "The university, the library, the palace, and the entire region surrounding these are ours. It is small in comparison with the planet itself, but it contains room enough, I think, for physical exercise. First Speaker, might we not begin?" The First Speaker sighed inwardly. He had the full power to keep the table waiting, or indeed to adjourn the meeting until a time when Jindabyne was present. No First Speaker could long function smoothly, however, without at least the passive support of the other speakers, and it was never wise to irritate them. Even Prem Pulver had occasionally been forced into cajolery to get his way. Besides, Jindabyne's absence was annoying, even to the First Speaker. The young speaker might as well learn he was not a law unto himself. And now, as First Speaker, he did speak first, saying, "We will begin. Speaker Jindabyne has presented some startling deductions from prime radiant data. He believes that there is some organization that is working to maintain the Selden plan more efficiently than we can, and that it does so for its own purpose. We must, in his view, therefore, learn more about it out of self-defense. You all have been informed of this, and this meeting is to allow you all a chance to question Speaker Jindabyne in order that we may come to some conclusions as to future policy." Was, in fact, even unnecessary to say this much. Shandess held his mind open, so they all knew. Speaking was a matter of courtesy. Delamy looked about swiftly. The other 10 seemed content to allow her to take on the role of anti-Jindabyne spokesperson. She said, "Yet Jindabyne," again the omission of the honorific, "does not know and cannot say what or who this other organization is." She phrased it unmistakably as a statement, which skirted the edge of rudeness. It was as much to say, "I can analyze your mind. You need not bother to explain." The First Speaker recognized the rudeness and made the swift decision to ignore it. The fact that Speaker Jindabyne, he punctiliously avoided the omission of the honorific, and did not even point up the fact by stressing it, "does not know and cannot say what the other organization is," does not mean it does not exist. The people of the First Foundation, through most of their history, knew virtually nothing about us, and in fact, know next to nothing about us now. Do you question our existence? "It does not follow," said Delamy, "that because we are unknown and yet exist, that anything in order to exist need only be unknown." And she laughed lightly. "True enough. That is why Speaker Jindabyne's assertion must be examined most carefully. It is based on rigorous mathematical deduction, which I have gone over myself, and which I urge you all to consider. It is," he searched for a cast of mind that best expressed his views, "it is not unconvincing." "And this First Foundationer, Golan Trevise, who hovers in your mind, but whom you do not mention?" Another rudeness, and this time the First Speaker flushed a bit. "What of him?" The First Speaker said, "It is Speaker Jindabyne's thought that this man, Trevise, is the tool, perhaps an unwitting one, of this organization, and that we must not ignore him." "If," said Delamy, sitting back in her chair and pushing her greying hair backward and out of her eyes, "if this organization, whatever it is, exists, and if it is dangerously powerful in its mental capabilities and is so hidden, is it likely to be manoeuvring so openly by way of someone as noticeable as an exiled councilman of the First Foundation?" The First Speaker said gravely, "One would think not. And yet I have noticed something that is most disquieting. I do not understand it." Almost involuntarily, he buried the thought in his mind, ashamed that others might see it. Each of the speakers noted the mental action, and, as was rigorously required, respected the shame. Delamy did too, but she did so impatiently. She said, in accordance with the required formula, "May we request that you let us know your thoughts, since we understand and forgive any shame you may feel?" The first speaker said, "Like you, I do not see on what grounds one should suppose Councilman Trevise to be a tool of the other organisation, or what purpose he could possibly serve if he were. Yet Speaker Genderball seems sure of it, and one cannot ignore the possible value of intuition in anyone who has qualified for Speaker. I therefore attempted to apply the plan to Trevise." "To a single person?" said one of the speakers in low-voiced surprise, and then indicated his contrition at once for having accompanied the question with a thought that was clearly the equivalent of "What a fool!" "To a single person," said the first speaker, "and you are right. What a fool I am. I know very well that the plan cannot possibly apply to individuals, not even to small groups of individuals. Nevertheless, I was curious. I extrapolated the interpersonal intersections far past the reasonable limits, but I did it in 16 different ways and chose a region rather than a point. I then made use of all the details we know about Trevise, a councilman of the First Foundation does not go completely unnoticed, and of the Foundation's mayor. I then threw it all together, rather higgledy-piggledy, I'm afraid." He paused. "Well," said Delamy, "I gather you... were the results surprising?" "There weren't any results, as you might all expect," said the first speaker. "Nothing can be done with a single individual, and yet... and yet... and yet? I have spent 40 years analysing results, and I have grown used to obtaining a clear feeling of what the results would be before they were analysed, and I have rarely been mistaken. In this case, even though there were no results, I developed the strong feeling that Genderball was right and that Trevise should not be left to himself." "Why not, first speaker?" asked Delamy, clearly taken aback at the strong feeling in the first speaker's mind. "I am ashamed," said the first speaker, "that I have let myself be tempted into using the plan for a purpose for which it is not fit. I am further ashamed now that I am allowing myself to be influenced by something that is purely intuitive. Yet I must, for I feel this very strongly. If Speaker Genderball is right, if we are in danger from an unknown direction, then I feel that when the time comes that our affairs are at a crisis, it will be Trevise who will hold and play the deciding card." "On what basis do you feel this?" said Delamy, shocked. First Speaker Shandis looked about the table miserably. "I have no basis. The psycho-historical mathematics produces nothing. But as I watched the interplay of relationships, it seemed to me that Trevise is the key to everything. Attention must be paid to this young man." XXV. Genderball knew that he would not get back in time to join the meeting of the table. It might be that he would not get back at all. He was held firmly, and he tested desperately about him to see how he could best manage to force them to release him. Rufferant stood before him now, exultant. "Be you ready now, scholar? Blow for blow, strike for strike, Hamish fashion. Come then, art the smaller, strike then first." Genderball said, "Will someone hold thee as I be held?" Rufferant said, "Let him go. Nana. His arms alone. Leave arms free, but old legs strong. We want no dancing." Genderball felt himself pinned to the ground. His arms were free. "Strike, scowler," said Rufferant. "Give us a blow." And then Genderball's probing mind found something that answered, indignation, a sense of injustice and pity. He had no choice. He would have to run the risk of outright strengthening, and then improvising on the basis of... There was no need. He had not touched this new mind, yet it reacted as he would have wished, precisely. He suddenly became aware of a small figure, stocky, with long, tangled black hair and arms thrust outward, careening madly into his field of view and pushing madly up the Hamish farmer. The figure was that of a woman. Genderball thought grimly that it was a measure of his tension and preoccupation, that he had not noted this till his eyes told him so. "Carol Rufferant," she shrieked to the farmer, "art bully and coward strike for strike, Hamish fashion.
You be two times yon scourge size, you be in more sore danger attacking me. Be there renown in passion yon poor spalp? There be shame, I'm thinking. It'll be a fair heap of finger-pointing, and they'll be full saying yon be rufferant, renowned baby-smasher. It'll be laughter, I'm thinking, and no decent Hamishman will be drinking with you, and no decent Hamish woman will be aught with you.
Rufferant was trying to stem the torrent, warding off the blows she was aiming at him, attempting weakly to answer with a placating,
"Oh, now, surer, surer now."
Genderbal was aware that hands no longer grasped him, that Rufferant no longer glared at him, that the minds of all were no longer concerned with him. Shura was not concerned with him either. Her fury was concentrated solely on Rufferant. Genderbal, recovering, now looked to take measures to keep that fury alive and to strengthen the uneasy shame flooding Rufferant's mind, and to do both so lightly and skilfully as to leave no mark. Again there was no need. The woman said,
"All of you backstep, look here. If it be not sufficient that this carol heap be like giant to the starveling, there must be five or six more of you ally friends to share in shame and go back to farm with glorious tale of derring do in baby smashing. I held the spalp's arm, you'll say, and giant rougher and block bashed him in the face when he was not to backstrike. And you'll say, but I held his foot, so give me also glory. And rougher and chunk will say, I could not have him on his lane, so my furrow mates pinned him, and with help of all six, I gloried on him."
"But surer," said Rufferant, almost whining, "I told Scholar he might have first strike."
"And fearful you were the mighty blows of his thin arms, not so Rufferant thick-head. Come, let him go where he can be going, and the rest of you to your home's back-crawl. If so be, those homes will still find a welcome-making for you. You had all best hope the grand deeds of this day be forgotten. And they will not be, for I be spreading them far and wide if you do make me any the more fiercely raging than I be raging now."
They trooped off quietly, heads hanging, not looking back. Genderbal stared after them, then back at the woman. She was dressed in blouse and trousers, with rough-made shoes on her feet. Her face was wet with perspiration, and she breathed heavily. Her nose was rather large, her breasts heavy, as best Genderbal could tell through the looseness of her blouse, and her bare arms muscular. But then the Hamish women worked in the fields beside their men. She was looking at him sternly, arms akimbo.
"Well, Scowler, why be lagging? Go on to place of Scowlers. Be you feared? Shall I company you?"
Genderbal could smell the perspiration on clothes that were clearly not freshly laundered, but under the circumstances, it would be most discourteous to show any repulsion.
"I thank you, Miss Shura." "The name be Novi," she said gruffly. "Shura Novi. You may say Novi. It be unneeded to more say." "I thank you, Novi. You have been very helpful. You are welcome to company me, not for fear of mine, but for company pleasure in you."
And he bowed gracefully, as he might have bowed to one of the young women at the university. Novi flushed, seemed uncertain, and then tried to imitate his gesture.
"Pleasure be mine," she said, as though searching for words that would adequately express her pleasure and lend an air of culture.
They walked together. Genderbal knew well that each leisurely step made him the more unforgivably late for the table meeting, but by now he had had a chance to think on the significance of what had taken place, and he was icily content to let the lateness grow. The university buildings were looming ahead of them, when Shura Novi stopped and said hesitantly,
"Master Scowler?"
Apparently, Genderbal thought, as she approached what she called the place of Scowlers, she grew more polite. He had a momentary urge to say, "Address you not yon poor spalp?" But that would embarrass her beyond reason. "Yes, Novi.
Be it very fine-like and rich in places, Scowlers?"
"It is nice," said Genderbal.
"I once dreamed I be in a place, and I be Scowler."
"Some day," said Genderbal politely, "I'll show it thee." Her look at him showed plainly she didn't take it for mere politeness. She said,
"'I can write. I be taught by schoolmaster. If I write letter to thee,' she tried to make it casual, "'how do I mark it so it come to thee?' "'Just say, Speaker's House, Apartment 27, and it will come to me. "'But I must go, Novi.' "'He bowed again, and again she tried to imitate the action. "'They moved off in opposite directions, and Genderbal promptly put her out of his mind. "'He thought instead of the table meeting, and in particular of Speaker Delora Delamy. "'His thoughts were not gentle.'